Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Annie Petsunk. I'm International Counsel at EDF, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you to join us for this discussion tonight on tackling climate change, which knows no boundaries. Some of you have come from very near, and some have come from very far. We're grateful, and we welcome you. I particularly want to thank Blakey and Bob Worth for coming tonight. Blakey is a founding trustee of the Environmental Defense Fund, and your courage and vision to establish this organization at the time that you did is an inspiration for each of us every day. Tonight, we're pleased to have with us a great panel of EDF experts. I'd like to introduce Dr. Nathaniel Cohan, EDF Senior Vice President for Climate, Julie Hess, Senior Manager in EDF's China Program, Britt Grusman, EDF's Vice President for Global Climate, who's pinch-hitting tonight for Briony Worthington, EDF's Executive Director in Europe. She had hoped to be here, but she's unable to join us tonight. And Dr. Kriti, who is senior manager in EDF's India program and a senior scientist in her own right. I'm going to begin by inviting each of our panelists to give us a little perspective on their work in the context of current events and shifting geopolitics. Then I'll open it up to questions from all of you. Please just raise your hand to ask a question, and we'll give you a microphone. We are recording tonight's discussion, and it's going to be made available to you and other EDF members as a podcast. We will be sending the link to tonight's recording around to you in the next few days. Nat, let's start with you. You're an economist. You're a professor. You're an advocate. You've served in the Obama White House. You know your way around the halls of Congress. You have tremendous perspective on this shifting political scene. What can you tell us this evening about public awareness of climate change and the need for climate action, and what's your perspective on the potential for getting that action?
Well, thanks, Annie, and thanks to all of you for coming tonight and for lending us your support and your interest and your actions over the years. It means so much to us. We're working on it every day, so thank you for coming. So I want to say a little bit about how we approach it globally to give you some context for the discussion and then touch really quickly on the U.S. as well. This month is a timely one to be having this conversation. Many of you may have seen earlier this month the UN science panel known as the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released a new report showing just how fast the planet is warming, just how fast those changes are coming that we can see every day, and just how little time we have left to start making meaningful action. At the same time, almost a few days later, we saw Hurricane Michael slam into the Florida panhandle. It accelerated almost overnight from a Category 3 to a Category 5 hurricane. And that kind of event, that kind of acceleration, is made possible by the warmer weathers, the warmer waters of the Gulf of Mexico that we know are in part attributable to the warming planet that we're doing. So it's a timely discussion. It seems like a daunting challenge, but it's one that we can solve if we put our minds to it and if we put our resources to it. And so I want to talk briefly about that context. We think about this as the first step we need to do globally if we're going to solve this problem is to stop emissions from rising and get them on a downward trajectory, to turn the corner on global greenhouse gas emissions and get the world on a path toward climate safety. Eventually, we need to drive emissions down all the way so that the amount we're putting into the air is balanced by what we're taking out. But the first step is going to be turning the corner. And so to achieve that, what we've done at EDF is identify the very biggest places we can be working, where we can have the most impact. And you're going to hear about many of those places today. It's the U.S., Europe, China, India. Those are the world's biggest emitters. and the ones where we think we can make immediate difference. And in each of those places, we're working to find the points of leverage that will help us accelerate change, the economics, the market-based incentives. You'll hear about all these themes as we go through the evening. And one of the things that's exciting about seeing EDF as a global organization, in a way that when Blakey and colleagues started it, we were started on a farmhouse on Long Island 50 years ago. Now we're an organization with an office in China, an office in Europe, soon an office in India, as we'll hear. And that global span helps us connect the dots and make sure that we can bring solutions to scale. So quickly, in the U.S., these are dark days in many ways for climate. I worked in the Obama administration, and it's hard, as someone who worked on many of the rules, to see them being challenged. And yet, we've got to be keeping our eyes on what we can do to rebuild going forward. So when we think about the U.S., I think about it in three ways. We work every day to defend the rules that we have in place, the regulations and the standards that protect our children's health and protect our climate, and we're working as hard as we can to slow down the onslaught to that. Every day we slow down is a day that we've won. We're also working to get progress in the states, and I think we can talk more about that later, because that's an area outside of Washington, D.C., where we are making progress, and we can make progress. And then we're building back for the day, which will come, when we'll have meaningful, significant climate action at the federal level, and it's already time now for us to be preparing for that, whether that's in 3 years, in 5 years. It's important for us to be doing that work now. I'm sure there'll be more interest in that and more talk about that, so I'll leave it there, except to say, Annie, you asked about public awareness. And I mentioned I mentioned Hurricane Michael when I started. I hate to call it a silver lining, because it's no silver lining for the people whose homes were devastated by the storm, but we are starting to see that those extreme weather events, the kind of changes that are happening in front of our eyes, I think we're starting to see that take hold and take effect, and people are starting to take notice. And so I think the public awareness is on our side here. I think it's growing, and what we have to do is take advantage of that and build the case for action and really accelerate change to meet this challenge. So thanks very much. I look forward to the questions.
Thanks, Nat. I'm going to turn now to Britt. Britt, you're from Belgium. You're based here in New York. Europe has been at the forefront of global climate action, but Europe is currently facing a lot of internal political strains. Brexit, shifting political winds, recent elections in Germany. Could you compare the level of engagement by voters and elected officials on the need for climate action in Europe as compared to the United States? And given these strains in Europe, what potential do you see for climate leadership in Europe today?
Thank you, Annie. Thank you, everybody who's here, and I am indeed pinch-hitting. I am from Belgium, have lived in the UK for a long time, so I can hopefully fill in on some of the questions if you would have questions about the UK. I think the environment in general and climate issues have long been at the forefront of European voters in the way that it hasn't been here. We have long had green parties be part of government coalitions, and Europe was at the forefront of getting first the Kyoto Protocol, which it ratified in 2002, and the US famously declined to ratify. And that really gave the impetus to really start getting a package of comprehensive measures that would really try and tackle climate change in Europe. And Europe now is, you know, when we talk about Europe, we talk about political Europe, so the 28 member states that are part of the sort of political package that all work together on climate issues. So I think it's quite different. Yes, there are, as there are everywhere around the world right now, there are parties that are really rallying against working on the environment, and that often goes with being against immigration and against many other things. Yet one of the things that Europe has in its favor that the US currently really doesn't, is that it never has had this level of true bifurcation where it is one or the other. pretty much every country in Europe is led by a coalition government. I've always seen it as the need to compromise within, even within your own country when you're making decisions. And then obviously when you are ruling 28 member states together, you have that same level of a need for compromise and a need for talking to each other, listening to each other. It often means that the green groups don't get exactly what they want, but then the groups that are really against it also don't really get what they want. And you end up with a sort of fairly happy medium in a lot of cases. And Europe has managed since the 90s to decline its greenhouse gas emissions quite rapidly. It has a very well-functioning emission trading system that tackles its climate change issues. It has long had, whether you're in favor of them or not, subsidies for things like solar. We can say what we want about Germany right now, but really Germany is the one that kickstarted the solar industry with its subsidies. So, yes, it isn't perfect. Brexit is a concern to many people, but I still feel like within the geopolitical world, Europe will continue to be a front runner for environmental policy. Thank you, Annie.
Thanks, Britt. Let's turn now to China. Julie, we know that China has surpassed the United States as the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases, responsible for nearly one-third of global emissions. But it's also the world's leader in terms of the installation rate of wind and solar. What needs to happen in China, and how is EDF China working to help get that done?
Thank you, Annie. That's a great question. And thank you for all of you who made EDF China program a possibility. And EDF China program has already been on the ground for 27 years. And I, for most of that part, had worked outside of EDF and observed that achievement. So our heartfelt thank you. To address your great question, I want to segment them into three parts. So what needs to be done? I want to use two words or two phrases to describe that. What needs to be done? In our mind right now, one goal, two steps. What is that one goal? I think for the major part of the past 27 years when EDF was introduced to China and into the China market, one thing that we tried really hard was to come to this point of a joint, very aligned recognition of climate change issues as a man-made issue. And China, to a large extent, is the biggest emitter, and that is a fact. And I think by today, even though maybe 10 years ago, there are still tons of people doubting that, thinking it's a conspiracy, there's no doubt about it anymore. From kindergarten kids to the president, who is a green president in China, we have a cross-the-board recognition, and that recognition comes down to this one goal, which is we have to take informed and timely emissions reduction action. So the two steps, and I want to echo a little bit about what Annette has been saying, and also this, you know, building onto EDF's global expertise and EDF's market-based expertise. For the past 20 years, when EDF was in China, one thing that we did on a daily basis was trying to help the local stakeholders, from the central government to the local government, from industrial leaders to the local communities, to understand why and what that needs to be done. So I think by last December, when China finally announced the launch of the National Emissions Trading Scheme, we consider that as a major victory, a major win. And for the following 20 years, another 20 years, what shall we do? And because of that UNFCCC report, and because of its large publicity in China, because of that joint and across-the-board recognition that China needs to get things done, needs to take timely action, it's really the how. How are we going to get that done because of the time constraint? And that's a key issue that EDF, because of our long history of ex-China, we can help. And because of our long history of being in China as a credible partner who gets things done in a timely accurate, and a scientific-based manner. That's what we're going to help them to figure out. And the third part I really want to come down to is the three programs that we're using and we're doing on the ground that really help to meet the one goal and the two steps that I just laid out. So the three programs, when we're thinking about China's emissions or climate impact, what are the low-hanging fruits? State-owned enterprises. In the biggest, the heaviest emitting industries, power sector. The 1,700 power facilities that are covered under the national ETS for the phase one period, those are the low-hanging fruits. And we're trying everything we can to work with the policy designer, the mechanism designer, the scientist, and also the economist on the ground, and also industrial associations, which are the critical gatekeeper to all those power companies, to get them to join this joint effort, to commit us to actual and transparent and accountable actions. So besides that, you know, and then we're looking at seven other sectors, which are eventually going to be included in the national ETS. But that still accounts for only 50% of China's emissions. What about the rest? So now we're looking at another group, the small and medium enterprises that account for more than 40% of China's emissions. And for them, what are the best way, the mechanism? Is it still national ETS, which would take years and years to include them? What about utilizing the purchasing power from their multinational corporation purchasers, the customers? That's why we're on the ground doing green supply chain work. We're adopting what the green supply chain work that we have been developing in the US and Europe and brought that to China. Then there's another risk. What about after 2009, when China launched the going out policy? China is everywhere now. There's the data. Because of the air pollution needs or control of air pollutions, we're looking at 100 coal power plants being shut down in China last year alone. But then at the same time, globally, according to a very credible data, over 700 more coal power plants are being built globally that has associations with either Chinese investment or Chinese technologies. What about them? The best way is to engage in green finance. We want the investor community to understand, and the Chinese government know that these locked-in effects will really contribute to the longer-term greenhouse gas emissions globally, and that is outside of China's boundaries. And if we're only relying on local policies to tackle them, to management, especially in developing countries who needs the power the most, we're going to be waiting until the end of the world. So we have to do something, and that's why we're working on our green investment, and especially for the Chinese investment overseas. So I really look forward to your great questions, and that's about what's going on in China and what are EDF doing right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie, and I'm sure you will get lots of questions about greening the supply chain in China, greening the external externally directed investment, and the China emissions trading system. But let's turn for a moment to India. Kriti, you spend about half your waking hours in the United States, half your waking hours in India, and I have to say those waking hours that Kriti spends working on climate change are more than most human beings are awake ever. You spend so much time thinking and working about tackling climate change in the context of India's enormous economic and social challenges. EDF has worked with partners in India for the past 9 years. But now we're opening an office in India. Kriti, that's very exciting. What can you tell us about the focus of EDF's work in India?
Thank you so much, Annie. And thank you to all of you for being here tonight. That's very encouraging. And it's great to see our extended family that's been supporting our work in so many different ways over the years. So, India. I'm sure everyone knows India now is fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases. It can overtake United States to be second largest by 2040. So we need to work there. Now, when we started in India 9 years ago, we knew that we had to deal with two Indias, so to speak, right? First India looks like maybe this building, this bright, shining building, right? It's literally called Shining India. It's the India that you can imagine has having information technology firms, incredible market opportunities, big global conglomerates, right? That's the India that makes it third largest economy in the world and fastest growing major economy. On the other hand, we have 70% of India still living in villages, right? Most of India still hasn't been built if you think about what the trajectory looks like for 2040. There are 170 million families, twice the number of families in the United States today, that grow food on less than 1 acre farms. A typical farm in the U.S. is 500,000, maybe 5,000 acres, okay? And they grow food there, and then they cook the food using wood. When you cook food using wood, your walls have black soot, and the kids can't breathe because they cook indoors. So that's the India that Indian government wants to bring financial and food and energy security too, right? So when we started in India 9 years ago, our focus was how do we work with the Indian government and our many, very many unique partnerships to reimagine how do we bring growth and food security and energy security to that India, 170 million families. We have now brought clean cook stoves. So imagine that wall with black soot. We have brought clean cook stoves to 250,000, quarter of a million families, through our partnerships with the Shining India. Yeah? And we are now about to scale that up to two states in India. I mean, 250,000 is a lot, but for Indian population, that's still a drop in the bucket. So we are trying to take our affordable, scalable, and inclusive model that we worked so hard on and bring it to multiple states. We are also working on what we call low-carbon farming. So look at ways where farming can bring more yields, more farm profits, and in the process, decrease emissions that come from farming. On the other hand, Indian government's priority is also to keep India shining, to bring more investment, right? And for that, it has to deal with its totally, absolutely shocking air pollution problem. According to Lancet Commission, India tops the number of deaths that are caused because of air pollution. 2.5 million a year. 2.5 million a year, right. And so we recognize this, EDF leadership thought, we have the expertise that we can bring to help Indian government deal with this. We can bring our expertise, our capacity, and bring the momentum necessary for tackling the air pollution problem. So there are these two prongs of our work in India. Low carbon rural development in a way that leapfrogs our dependence on dirty energy, right? The usual way to bring energy and food security to 170 million families would be build hundreds of more coal power plants. And we are thinking of ways to leapfrog that. And on the other hand, we want to help with the air pollution problem, which is so intimately tied with climate pollution. So together, we are laying the groundwork necessary to do what Nat was talking about, you know, turn the corner, bend the trajectory of India's emissions. So I look forward to going deeper with your questions.
So think of your questions. Before I open it up for questions, I'm just going to ask Nat a question that I think is on many people's minds. Nat, as we head into the midterm elections, with the potential for a majority on the Supreme Court to overturn existing federal climate rules, and a majority potentially that could block efforts by the states to tackle climate change. What do you see as the prospects for progress? Which states are you focused on with that backdrop in mind, and why?
Well, thanks. I think as I mentioned in my opener, we're looking for places where we can make progress in the near term that builds towards progress at the federal level in the longer term. And we're looking for states that can put policies in place now that show the power of setting enforceable limits on pollution and using flexible market-based approaches to meet those limits. So I think of states in sort of two categories here. One, you've got leadership states that are already showing what these policies look like. California is the best example. About a dozen years ago, in 2006, EDF co-sponsored the landmark climate law in California. It's known as AB 32, the name of the assembly bill. And a core part of that was to create a cap and trade program that sets a declining limit on carbon pollution in California and creates a market mechanism to achieve that in the most flexible and cost-effective way possible. So California is now ahead of it. It's already beaten its 2020 target. That cap-and-trade program is not the only policy in place. There's lots of other policies California has put in place to help drive emissions down. But that cap-and-trade program will be a critical part, especially as California looks ahead, having met its 2020 target, which was to get emissions back to 1990 levels. California is now saying, we've done so well, we're going to take on a target of cutting emissions by 40% by 2030, which makes California one of the most ambitious places anywhere. So you've got California, you've got other leadership states, New York, we have right now, we have a emissions trading program to limit emissions from our electric power sector. The northeastern states are part of that. But there are also other states, and I think especially from the political point of view, it's the states in the heartland that are most interesting. Because if you go to Capitol Hill and you say, hey, California is doing this, they'll say, oh, California, you know, that's crazy. That's a different country. So we're working in Colorado and Minnesota and Pennsylvania to show how these same solutions can work there. Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado, who's finishing up his term, one example, we worked with him last year to put an executive order in place that sets a statewide limit on emissions that is in line with the U.S. Paris commitment. That's a great example. Washington, D.C. may be trying to walk away from the Paris Climate Agreement, but Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper and other governors are saying, we'll do our share. And so the next step is to work with the governor and his staff to put in, with his successor to put in place the kind of mechanisms that could achieve that goal. So we're working both with those leadership states like California, but also with a new breed of states that I think will show the real political possibilities for climate action.
Thanks, Nat. Now let's go to your questions. Brigitte and her team, including Ian at the microphone controls and Michelle and Monica, are going to make it possible for you to ask questions. Michelle and Monica have microphones, and they're going to be bringing them around the room. Just raise your hand, and when you have the microphone, for the benefit of our podcast listeners, please ask your question clearly and tell us your name and maybe your interest. I was talking with someone earlier who's a nurse, and she might be interested in the relationship between climate and health. Let us know some of your interests as you ask your questions. Questions.
Right here. Hi. My name is Chris Wilson. I come from a business marketing background, and so my question somewhat relates to the marketing side of things. Looking at that UN report that we talked about, the sense I got from the media coverage was that we have maybe two good decades to really make some strong moves to make some progress on this before things kind of can start spinning out of control. With that being said, what can we do to, I guess, from a marketing standpoint or from a public policy standpoint, be more impactful against the politicians, against people who are standing in the way of this progress. So, like, on the other side, if you look at the NRA, even though I don't necessarily like what they're doing, from a marketing standpoint or from a stranglehold on legislation standpoint, you could see with not as many members, they're still able to do a lot. What is standing in the way of, you know, the EDF or other environmentally focused organizations from having that same kind of impact and really owning the politicians and stopping them from being more beholden to corporations and polluters than they are to the interests of the people and the environment?
Matt, please.
Thanks, Chris, for that great question. So I'll start by saying this has long been a challenge on the issue of climate change because, you know, it's often been thought of as a problem that's going to happen in 50 years to people on the other side of the world. People think about it as if this is future generations, it's our children's children. What we're finding and what we're seeing is that it's happening now. And that's one of the messages of this UN report, that we're already seeing the impacts of climate accelerating faster than we expected. But it's also something we can see, many people can see evidence of in their, you know, in their own lives. I mean, it was around this time 6 years ago that Superstorm Sandy slammed into the Rockaways and the New Jersey Shore. So for people here who lived through that and saw the New York subways be flooded for the first time in history, in part because of a sea level that's almost a foot higher at the Battery than it was before climate change, I think that starts to make a difference. So I think as we start to see these extreme weather events, the kind of changes that are happening before our eyes, I think that's something we need to build on to break through that sense of this is going to happen in 50 years to someone else. And I think we're starting to see that. So let me give you one more example. And this is a nice example also because it's a bright spot of bipartisan possibility. One of the champions, there are not many, but one of the champions we have for climate change on the Republican side of the aisle right now in Congress is Carlos Curbelo, who's a representative from South Florida. Why is Carlos Curbelo a champion on climate? What made him get religion? His district floods on sunny days because of the rise in sea level. So Representative Curbelo sees this every day. His constituents see it every day, and that's something that pushes through the noise and says, okay, this has to rise up to be a top issue. So I think in answer to your question, from a marketing point of view, what do we need to do better? We need to connect the dots for people so they see that the changes they're already seeing to the places they love, to the places they live in, that those changes are already happening and that they're only going to accelerate unless they raise their voice and call for action. And so I think we're starting to see that, but there's much more that we have to do on that front to accelerate that.
And Britt, I know you'd like to add a little bit to that, please.
Yes, I would just like to add the point of, yes, it's really important that people start seeing it and that they, you know, from a marketing perspective. The other thing that has stopped action for decades is the fear that it will change our life the way it is now, that it will destroy our economy. So putting the two messages together that climate action is possible to, at the same time with a vibrant economy the way it is in California right now, the way it has been in Germany for parts of, you know, when the rest of Europe was in recession, etc., is very strong points. So making those two points, we are not attacking your way of life, which is what the NRA is very good at. It's important. It's happening. We have climate, you know, effects right now, and we can afford it, and it will not destroy your way of life. I think those two messages together from a marketing perspective are ones that we really need to start bringing forward.
Next question, please. We'll take two questions in this next round, please.
Steve Eisdorfer, who am I? I'm a working attorney. I am both counsel to the New Jersey Builders Association and also outside counsel to the state of New Jersey for shore protection. More than 40 years ago, in the what now seems prescient study, The Limits of Growth. The authors of that study said, by the time we see the impact of global warming, it will be too late to do anything about it. Are we too late?
Nat, please.
No. Or we wouldn't be here. And I think it's important to say why. The time is urgent, and if we had started this 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 10 years ago, we'd have an easier task in front of us. And yet, at the same time, we know we can make progress, in part because we're already seeing the fruit of the decades of work we've done so far. So look at the progress we're seeing in the wind and solar energy. This is something, even 10 years ago, everyone said, well, you know, the problem in energy is that wind and solar are carbon-free, but they're so expensive, and they're never going to compete with coal. Well, guess what? Now, in the U.S., wind power is cheaper than coal power on a straight-up basis, and solar is getting to that point. We've seen reductions of something like 90% in the costs of solar and 70%, I think, in the cost of wind just in a decade. You're starting to see new technologies. Battery storage, electric vehicles are becoming a real thing, and seeing them on the road. So we're starting to see the fruit of some of that technological change, and that's one of the tailwinds that's going to blow in our direction. We need to accelerate that change with the kind of policies that will reward even more investment and deployment and attention to those new technologies that are going to take us to where we need to go. But we're not starting from scratch. And I like to say one of the reasons that gives me hope is that we have only just begun to scratch the surface of one of the most powerful tools we have, which is human creativity and entrepreneurship. If we put policies in place that harness market forces that align the profit incentive with cleaning up the earth, with reducing pollution and taking it out of the sky rather than digging fossil fuels up and burning them. If we can align the incentives that private actors face so that they're rewarded for figuring out new and cheaper and better ways to cut pollution, we'll unleash a huge amount of energy and entrepreneurial creativity that I think will accelerate change faster than we can imagine. So we've seen progress. It's not nearly fast enough. But if we put the policies in place that will really reward the kind of innovation that will get us to the next level, I think we'll see much faster progress than we think is possible.
Kriti, I know you want to add a little bit more, and then we'll go to two more questions.
I just wanted to add a slightly scientific response to that wonderful question. I hear it a lot as a scientist. It might be too late for saving, let's say, Arctic permanent ice cover. So there are multiple tipping points in the planet's system. It might be too late for one of them, but there are hundreds. We still have a lot of time, and we need to do everything Nat laid out to stop Greenland from melting and Antarctica, East Antarctica or West Antarctica from melting or losing our Amazon rainforest and all of our coral reefs, right? So I hope that helps. It's people say we are past the tipping point, but there are many, many tipping points, and we need to keep that in mind.
Let's go to a question in the back of the room, please.
Yes, hello. My name is May Falk. I'm from the Meadowlands. I'm an environmental educator. I have two questions. One involves India and China together, both of these, and the other one involves the United States in the way of economics. In regard to India and China, I wanted to ask, because I am an educator and I've met educators from China, not so much India, but how is global warming or climate change, I should say, in the classroom over there? Is it being taught in the classroom for both countries? And then I'm just going to say the second one, and you can think about it. The second one is, I know for a fact that if you go through the United States, we have, as you said, wind energy. throughout the United States, from New Jersey all the way out to Montana and past. We have a lot of wind energy. Has anyone used that electoral block with the farmers as a way of encouraging them, instead of to vote that would be against the environment, toward it? Because they have it on their farms. There are 1,000-acre farms. They have lots of wind turbines, you know. So, I mean, they're getting money for this. So it would be in their benefit to think about changing their way of voting if anyone just decides, hey, you know, this is definitely going to affect you and how your bottom line at the end of your year.
Two great questions. I'd like to take one more question here. Over here, please. Yes. Oh, thank you. Hi. Sorry. My name is Shannon Sachs. I'm an art historian from NYU and an animal rights activist and staunch vegan. Can you speak about meat production and eliminating it, the emissions from the brutal farming industry? I was listening last week to a piece on NPR about eliminating, animal productions and farms and slaughtering and how it affects the environment. So let's take these questions. First, the question on education about climate change in the classroom in China and in India. Julie, do you want to start us off with that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Thank you. And I actually want to use the way that I address that question to also respond to the other great questions. I think the reason China cares about climate change are threefolded. First and foremost, even though the People's Republic of China was only since 1949, and we're now celebrating the 40 years of opening up and reform from 1979, we Chinese tend to think about the human being, about our own country, for thousands of years of history. And when we look back for thousands of years, we want to think about the next 1,000 years, not just the next 100 years. That's why climate change matters. And second is that because that affects our children and our children's children, so that's what matters to us, and we internalize that. We start to see the risk, the urgency of it. And the question is that whether we can combine that short-term goal with that of the long-term goal. And the third immediate reason is that if you have followed up media coverage on China for the past 5 years, one thing that pop up the most frequent, aside from other things about China, is air pollution. I personally lived in Beijing during its worst air pollution, and we know how it feels day to day. So the environmental impact, the question of even if you have loads of money, even if your economic development, the GDP shoots up to the sky, that doesn't matter. Your children can breathe, you can breathe, even president couldn't breathe. So we have to address that. So it comes back to the question of children and also whether that's integrated into school textbook. First and foremost, yes. Because we care about science, we care about math, and there are a lot of discussions about, you know, biology and also the science impact, and they're using multiple ways to deal with this. And children is actually because of the children are always placed in the center of Chinese family, just like any other families, or even more so, and one-child policy now loosening up. I think from our experience dealing with the local authorities who came to the U.S., there's always discussions about, you know, came to the U.S. to talk about how to let the public come on board with certain policies that's either environmental friendly or that can address climate change issues. They would always want to know about the strategies that we incorporate to help the public to bring up their awareness, so to speak, the marketing. So there are different clips, different kind of videos, and different even kinds of apps that are developed. And it's not just for, you know, and it's catering to different stages of education, you know, university, high school, middle school. And even more so, I think there are more and more activities on the campus at different levels are addressing the climate change and also environmental issues. And usually that's tied together. Thank you.
Kriti, do you want to talk with us a little bit about education about climate change in India, and if you also want to touch on the question about meat production?
Sure. I think Indian culture and just the way we think about life, I was so moved by how Julie described it. It's like, you know, looking at what is it that our ancestors have handed down to us, and what are we going to give to not just next generation, but seven generations from now. That's the outlook for 170 million families that I was talking about. That's the mindset. It's a little different for the shining India, the middle class India. Having said that, our college education, university education, absolutely emphasizes on climate change, causes of climate change, very clearly. The awareness among Indian youth, and EDF has worked on that, it's really high. I would rate it in top five, among the top five in the world. The penetration of climate education at the middle school level is, I think, still lacking. It's mentioned in the books, but it could go deeper. So that's my take on it. Regarding the meat production, Britt, did you want to?
Why don't you go first now?
Okay. We are working very directly with the farmers on not the demand side, but the supply side. So our work in India is focused on how to make the supply chain, the value chain, more efficient, and in the process decrease emissions that come from growing crops. Indian emissions from the animal agriculture sector are, you know, on a per capita basis, are probably the least in the world. So we haven't looked at the issue of animal agriculture so clearly in India, but I'm happy to talk more about the farming.
Sure. I'm happy to say something about this, but also not an expert, but so people can sort of pinch in as well. So obviously it's a very big issue. It's a very emotional issue. At the moment, what we're focusing, I lived in Brazil for a couple of years, and what we're focusing on at the moment is, for instance, in Brazil, we're focusing on trying to save the Amazon. And ranching is one of the things that is driving deforestation. So in that way, it's very related. And we are sort of working closely with both the governments and the ranchers on the deforestation issues. On the meat production itself, we are not currently at EDF working on the issue of driving that down. And I think one of the reasons is that we have to be de facto selective about what we can do. We could work in every country and every issue, or we could choose where we think we have the best value added. And at the moment, the meat production has not sort of come to the forefront for us. But I'll let Nat pinch in as well.
I'll wrap up on that and then mention the wind energy question briefly. And I know we've got other questions. On the meat, I think it's one thing we think a lot about at EDF is where we've got the most leverage and where other groups are doing really good work. And I think that if you look at the, as you said, exactly as you said, if you look at the major sources of greenhouse gases, cattle or just livestock generally, methane from livestock is one of the leading sources globally. It's one of the biggest ones. And for many of us in this room, behind aviation, which we could talk about, behind airlines, meat consumption is probably one of the big, or for some of us, maybe a big part of our carbon footprint. At the same time, we think the solutions to that are probably the kinds of solutions that other groups are going to be better at doing. Mass behavior change, meatless, the kind of Meatless Monday campaigns, that sort of thing is something that's really going to be vital and not something that we bring a special expertise to. And that's part of the tough part about, setting strategy and maintaining our focus is figuring out where we think we can do best and where we're going to let other groups lead. So you're absolutely right to say this is a critical issue, and there are some great groups doing work on it. Briefly on the wind energy piece, I love that question. You know, one of the wind is a great example where, as you bring clean energy and a low carbon future into today, and you integrate that into the fabric of economies, you start changing the politics. So I think about Chuck Grassley, who's not my favorite senator in the chamber, but Iowa has more than 20% of its energy now, its electricity coming from wind, and so it turns out that Chuck Grassley is a fan of wind power. That doesn't mean he is yet at the point where he's going to be pressing for comprehensive climate legislation, but he does say, well, we need those wind subsidies. And so that's the kind of change you can get when you start changing the fabric of the economy. When you start integrating it in, you get more and more people saying, okay, now I see why this is a path forward for us. In terms of farmers, we could talk much more, but I will say, we work with a number, EDF, our colleagues in our ecosystems program work with farmers around the country, and they are increasingly seeing the impacts of climate change on their crops. And, you know, you talk to farmers, family farmers, the thing they have most on their mind is, how am I going to pass this on to my kids? And so when they start seeing the way that climate is in conversation, yields, it's impacting their businesses, this is no longer an abstract thing, and that's where that conversation begins with those farmers. So we're starting to see that in our partnerships, and we're starting to think, how do we take advantage of that to have them raise their voices in the political sphere as well?
Now, I've disproportionately called on people from the left side of the room. It's time for the right side of the room, please. Let's start with you here in the front row here.
Not at all. Well, thank you. With respect to Europe, does it really matter whether Brexit comes off or doesn't? In other words, is the feeling in Britain, the UK, the same as the rest of continental Europe?
And let's take another question from the right side of the room, right behind. There we go.
Hi, Jason Higgins. My question is for Julie. You mentioned in your opening remarks about some financing opportunities in Southeast Asia. And I was curious, it's expected, at least the last report I read, that nearly 40% of energy growth in Southeast Asia is going to come from coal-fired power plants. How can we help China show up as a leader in terms of using its resources to help some of these countries find alternative forms of energy?
So let's take these two questions. Britt, please.
Sure. So the Brexit issue is a tricky one. So the UK has long been one of the sort of front runners on climate policy. It had its own climate policy before the EU had a climate policy. So what that means is that both that within the EU 28 member state bloc, it was a strong supporter. So if you lose that country, if it's no longer within the European Commission, would that dampen? I think right now, not, but of course, you know, politics being what they are, I think there's a lot of countries, the Scandinavian countries, Belgium, where I'm from, who are pulling for climate policy to continue to be very ambitious. And in effect, if the UK does spin off from the EU, what that will give the UK the opportunity to be way more ambitious than the EU is. You know, I was talking earlier about, you know, the 28 member states, and you always have to get to a compromise. So maybe I'm looking at this totally through pink glasses, but who knows? You know, Brexit, will it happen or not? You know, people are still asking for a second referendum. But I think the momentum in Europe as a bloc is so strong, pro-climate policy, that the UK leaving will not alter it. And if the UK goes out on its own, I think it will stay at least as ambitious, if not more ambitious, than the rest of Europe. So all around, I think positive.
Julie.
Thank you. That's a great question. So I think for the green finance work, we divide it almost into two parts. One is what we're doing domestically in China, and the other is really impacting on the China outside, which does not only confine to Southeast Asia. You know, Latin America, Africa, where there are Chinese investment, a lot of them have to do with energy investment. And it's really about two things when we're thinking about green finance. One, what we're doing is that we're working very closely with the People's Bank of China and where the central bank in China has this special working group on green finance. And what they're trying to establish is a benchmark, a standard that can guide the Chinese companies that are going outside to ensure about the risk factors are minimized. And environmental factor is a key risk factor. So it's not just confined to environment, but we're contributing to anything that has to do with the environment, both short-term as the environmental impacts and also the long-term as the climate impact. And that's number one. And number two is really through the first element, emissions trading scheme. One thing that we're working with NEST team on is really to establish, hoping to establish, a across-the-board carbon pricing scheme that wherever you go, maybe in 5 years, 10 years, there will be a linked carbon market, and there will be one carbon price. Wherever you go, that price will be on you. If you choose a very low carbon pathway, you are the winner. There's competitive advantage. But if you're not, then I'm sorry, for the following all the years down the road, that will be on you. So those are the two things currently we're working on. And even more importantly, on the longer run, what we're trying to do is to also build up the human capacity. So people are the core of implementing these policies or executing them and making sure they're true to what the policy design origins or the purposes are. We're doing two things on that front. One is that we're constantly hosting capacity building. Last year alone, we hosted two capacity building for Southeast Asian officials that are working with China to understand about the emissions trading scheme that China has done so successfully at the local level, the seven pilots, at least as a start. I mean, the success here, we're talking about different measurement, but in China's mind, that's a success. And then also helping them to understand the plan as of a next step. And eventually, China has been one of the biggest CDM, the Certified Emissions Reduction Contributor to the world. So China knows all about incentive and knows about this is for our core competitive advantage, not because someone pressured us to do that. So that's number one. The other is that we're also investing in the youth. EDF has a climate core program, which before we're sending them to multinational corporations based in China to have all these graduates who have passion for environment, who have the skill set, and they're working to help them address short-term environmental systematic issues, technical issues. In the longer run, we're going to recruit people from Southeast Asia, from Africa, from Latin America that are studying in China, who has the Chinese capacity, who understands, to also join those programs, and eventually they're going back to their country to serve on this bigger cause. So those, I hope that suffice, and we would like to recommendations, also suggestions. Thank you.
Julie, if I could just ask you two more questions in that regard, and I have to give a disclaimer, I actually live in Washington, D.C., not in New York, and my house has a basement. That's a good thing because between the hours of roughly 3 a.m. and 5 a.m., it's when it's easiest to reach Julie's colleagues in China on WeChat, which is an app which you can talk on the phone with people in China. And so this morning, I was down in the basement, not waking my family, talking with one of Julie's colleagues who was actually in Japan at a Japan-China-Korea linking emissions trading systems a discussion that EDF co-sponsored. So what Julie talks about in terms of this vision of a carbon price wherever you go is very powerful vision and people are gravitating to it. Julie, how many environmental enforcement officers has EDF trained in China?
That's a great question. Thank you. And thank you for the late night calls or early morning calls to work with China. So China overall has 82,000 environmental enforcement officers. By the end of last year, we trained half of that, which is 40,000 environmental enforcement officers. And even last week, I went to D.C. to accompany a group of environmental enforcement officers to come here to study about all the U.S. best practices in the environmental enforcement sectors or segment. So thank you.
Thanks. Let's take two more questions on this side. Sir, here you've been waiting patiently, and then in the back.
My name is Brian Hagerty. One of the reasons the National Rifle Association is so effective is that they send out mailings before most elections giving ratings of the candidates their members are going to vote on for federal or state offices. I'm not aware of the EDF sending out such mailings, and I'm wondering if the EDF should send out mailings with some kind of environmental rating for candidates running for state and federal office before each election.
Great question. And I also promised to the back, yes. Third, tall hand there. Yes.
Me? Okay. My name is B. Junali Hunter. I'm vice chair of a social change organization named We the World and a longtime supporter of EDF. Thank you so much for all you do and giving us a chance and a way to express our environmental concerns. I went to an environmental event some time ago promoting a book, which I hope it's okay to mention, named Drawdown, which was presented there as including a circle divided into 100 sectors, each sector being an approach to sustainability. And the cost of each of those sectors was listed along with whatever that sector's path to sustainability was. My question is, have you ever heard of this book? And if you have, any thoughts or comments you might have about it would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, so let's take, Nat, do you want to take both of those? And then I think Kriti might also come.
Absolutely. So two great questions. Thank you. On the first one, I'll note, first of all, there's a group that does that exactly that. It's a great group, one of the ones we work very closely with, the League of Conservation Voters. And so if they weren't already doing it, I think that is something we would need to step in to do, and they do a great job of that. So if you are interested in that and finding out more about what your representatives or senators, I mean, we live in a part of the world where, at least those of us who live in New York City, most of our representatives and certainly our senators are pretty good on these issues, and yet they could always lead more. And so it's always a value in raising your voice. And if you live elsewhere, you may find real value wherever you live in the kind of information that League of Conservation's LCV puts together. So I'd really encourage you to look for that. I'll say EDF. We do have an action fund that plays much more of a role in political campaigns. EDF is a nonprofit. We steer clear of political campaigns, but we have an arm that is separate, but that we, that we communicate with, that has separate funds and separate staff and so on, that does more of the political campaign work on both sides of the aisle. But for those kind of ratings you're talking about, LCV does really terrific work. And then in terms of the Project Drawdown, so Paul Hawken is the main author of that book, and I remember being inspired by one of Paul's earlier books back in the 90s. That's one reason I got into the environmental movement in the first place. So I think the work and the work of Drawdown, as B, you described it, is to identify, what are the biggest areas, the 100 things that the world could do that would help us tackle this problem. Sorry, and the cost. Yes. So I think that's an incredibly valuable exercise, really rich information there. When we take that, we look at it through an additional lens, which is, which of those do we think we have the tools and the leverage, we can identify the points of leverage and what we call the theory of victory to win on those. And so, in fact, when we put our strategic plan together for 2015, so we were doing this about 5 years ago, we took a very similar approach. What are the biggest What are the biggest sources of emissions? What's our theory of victory for influencing them? Where are others doing really good work? We talked about meat earlier, so that EDF doesn't need to lead. We can support others. And where is there a gap we can step into? And so that's the frame we've used, which is in many ways similar to what Paul is doing. And I think if he can build broader support for a sense of we can do this and here are the ways, the things we need to pursue, I think it'll be a terrific effort.
I'll just quickly add to that. So Jonathan Foley has just joined as director of Project Drawdown, and he's a great supporter of Environmental Defense Fund, and especially our science work in India. He's been a great champion of that. And I'm just adding to what Nat said. In India, for example, according to Project Drawdown's classification, clean cook stoves would be a big category, and so would be agroforestry, right? So we are already active in those areas, and as Nat said, we are asking the questions. So yes, clean cook stoves are a big pie in that circle, but how do we make it possible by linking it with market mechanisms? So to give you an example, just last month at the California Global Climate Action Summit, Mahindra Group's leader, Anand Mahindra, announced that they will, by 2040, make their 1.5 million carbon dioxide tons equivalent Mahindra Group carbon neutral by 2040. And EDF has a big role in that announcement. We are going to help connect our clean cook stoves, right, to their carbon neutrality goal. So we are arranging the funding, the lining up the incentives for the pies that have been identified in that book that you spoke about. So just wanted to add that layer.
Speaking of both sides of the aisle, I'm going to take two questions from this side and two questions from this side. So we're going to have four questions at a time because we're coming close to the hour here, and we'll take two questions right here. And then
thank you. A question for China and India.
And your name, sir?
Eric Zinn. I'm an environmental educator and a semi-founder of a solar energy company. Okay. Relating to China and India's goals to reduce global warming gases, in 2000-2001, I lived in Suzhou, Jiangsu province, in the greater Shanghai area, for those who don't know. And I was aghast at how filthy it was. I'd get up every morning and I'd dust the coal dust off my windowsill. The air was virtually unbreathable. The water I was told not to drink, especially because they floated bodies down the Wangpu River a long time ago. But the point I'm making is, as India and China's middle class is growing, and there's pressure on people wanting to buy cars, in my first time in China in 2000-2001, most of the people drove motorcycles, motorbikes, electric and gas, and bicycles. When I went back in 2001 to visit my fellow educators, more people had small cars. When I went back in 2008, almost everyone, even though the teachers I worked with were middle class, they all had cars. Even the school had a Buick. The point I'm making is that since General Motors Buick is now importing a small SUV from a joint venture factory in China, their technology to improve fuel economy and emissions already exists in China. Why is there no pressure on other Chinese manufacturers to incorporate U.S. standards of environmental control, both for carbon dioxide as well as hydrocarbon and nitrous oxide emissions, which is fairly well controlled in the U.S., China, they are within trouble in China and India. Now, again, I'm more familiar with China than with India, but the question really is for both of you. How to deal with the growing middle class and their pressure to consume, consume, and consume.
Next question on this side of the aisle, then we'll take two more on this side of the aisle.
I'm Sally Letterman. I'm from Columbia University, and my professional focus is nutrition and public health. So I first want to make a statement that we have been changing consumption of beef. While beef is going down, chicken is going up, and that should be a positive trend in terms of gas. But I also have another broad question. I'm always amazed when we start talking about issues like these that the issue of population growth is left totally on the side. In my lifetime, the world population, I think it's tripled, maybe more than that, but roughly. And I'm looking ahead to it going up by another 30% potentially. And there just seems to be so much that we could do in that, in helping people achieve the family size they want, not even getting them to want smaller families. And every single problem that we talk about today, if you go back to, say, where it wasn't such a problem before, it's because there were fewer people. And I'd like to know what can be done about that, having that contribute.
Take two more questions from this side of the aisle, and then we'll put all the answers together.
Hi. My name is Jenny Hogreef, and I'm a student at the New School. My question's for Nat. You talked about California as being an example of a climate leader. And as you might know, in September, his summit was protested by organizations that were essentially calling him out for his 20,000 some permits to extract fossil fuels throughout his tenure. I'm wondering if you believe we should hold climate leaders like Jerry Brown, who has been sort of raised up in the age of Trump as sort of our saving grace, to a higher standard, and how we work with progressive-minded government officials to really kind of hold their feet to the fire to say, you're doing great work in some areas, but the concessions you're making in others might undercut that progress.
And one more question over here. We have several people up front who've been waiting very patiently. Sir, here in the second row on the end. Thank you.
Yes. So my name is Pete Klosterman. Personally, a retired software engineer, but in terms of perspective, my father grew up on a farm. He got a PhD, got a job at Ohio State University in their agriculture department, and devoted his life to better beef production. And so I'm very interested in knowing a little bit about it. And I'm very interested about what you found to be most effective in terms of dealing with ranchers who aren't going to stop doing what they did. You know, they love their, you know, their cattle, they love their job. And what's most effective in terms of making that, you know, not as little impact on the climate as possible.
Okay, so let's start with Eric's question about the growing middle class in China and India. Julie and then Kriti.
So, Eric, thank you so much for that question. I personally share that concern every single day. I was born in China in the 1980s. The best luxury we can have at the time was a bike, a fridge. But now these days, you go back home, everyone has two cars. You know, the same kind of penetration rate as it is here. And it's really about this growing pain. And people just want to consume more because before they never had the luxury of doing that. And now everything's ready for them to do. So to cut my answer very short and to the point, I think Chinese society is going through a reflection. Although because of the disparity between East and West, because of disparity between, you know, there are still all these people at the bottom maybe that are still looking for better earning opportunities than maybe getting a car. And there are all these super rich people that are in Beijing and Shanghai or Hong Kong. That I think the country is trying to redistribute the wealth in a fashion that everyone is getting more equal and that everyone can be more rational about their consumption. Recently, there are two documentaries in China that really woke people up and that really came back to the marketing that we're talking about. One is called Plastic China, and there was literally this town that was just completely torn by all the plastics. And also last year, you probably have heard about China start to banning all the electronic waste going into China to be reprocessed. So I think really people start to engage on the thinking about short term and long term because now we can afford to. But then there's also another phenomenon that's going on in big cities that really concerns me. And EDF is not in that area yet, but we're going to the plastic packaging. The, you know, the Alibabas or Tencent that are out there or even the delivery services that is so convenient, so cheap, so easily accessible, that gives you access to all the great restaurants nearby in such a discounted way, but still that came up with all the packaged food. That's just another layer of what we don't need. And then people don't go to the big shopping malls anymore. It's all online. But then that comes back to let us think, okay, where does this China reconcile with the China I just talked about that I want to think about 1,000 years from now or even down the road? So I think the government is really trying very hard. And really the key, the solutions, I think, lies in two areas. One is really technology. So just like I think there's a very well EDF saying internally, we say nobody in, you know, gives you any even economic incentive to change from the horse wagon into a car. That just happened because of the scale up, because of the cheaper technology. Once that become accessible, cheaper and better, why don't we do that leap forward technologically and have people just still use the same price to get a better, more sustainable way of consumption? So that's number one. Number two is that you probably, you're in the solar business, so you know all about Chinese subsidies. With the renewable energy vehicle and electronic vehicle, you probably have heard about this company called BYD, which is the biggest battery maker and also the taxi and also all the electronic vehicle maker. Years ago in Xi'an, they piloted this EV taxi services. So now it's all EV. But the question then comes down to where does that power come from? Is it still coming from the coal? Yeah, exactly. So we have to work on both sides. We have to ensure the transportation sector is getting cleaner and more sustainable. But at the same time, we need to ensure all the infrastructures, the Teslas, the BYDs on China's roads, or even all these joint ventures that are brought by Nissan, by all those, you know, GM with the Chinese partners, to joint ventures. When they're producing all these EVs and they're going to replace the old generation of cars, they're consuming the green power and they're going to be able to rely on their own, not so much heavily on the government subsidies. So those are the things that EDF are engaging on the front line with the policymakers, with the industrial leaders. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. I'm going to turn to Kriti, and Kriti, I'm going to ask you to take both the growing middle class in India question and the on population growth.
Sure. So I'm going to go back to the framing I used in my introductory remarks, right? Yes, there is the growing middle class in India, very similar to China's, but it's only 20%, actually just 5% of the Indian population. A lot of the Indian population, 70%, is still in villages. I'm going to let Nat respond to how we are thinking about the car standards. But I'm going to come back to the 70% of Indian population and how it relates to the issue of population that we spoke about. Two points here. Number one, you might have seen the statistics already. Per capita carbon emissions from India, 2 tons, maybe 2.5. And here we look at any number between 30, maybe even 40. It goes up to 60, 70 easily if we do flying, right, take flights. So population is certainly an issue. However, it trumps the issue of what is our per capita use of resources. And that is exactly what we are trying to leapfrog for the 70% of India. And then the second issue where we are doing work, the population rate, the number of children and family has, is directly related to how educated the woman of the family is, and that's something that's built in our low carbon rural development efforts. So we work with farmer groups and women farmer groups, and education is a crucial piece. If that's not built in, they will not understand the interventions we are bringing to the table, where we are trying to make a case for what we called triple win, right? Use these practices, A, B, and C, and your crop yields will go up, your farm income will go up, and in the process, there will be environmental or climate benefit. So I could speak a lot more about it after we finish officially, but that's how I think about the population question.
Thank you, Kriti. Nat, let me turn to you now if you want to comment more on the population question and also on Jenny's question about challenging progressive politicians to achieve even higher standards.
Thanks. So let me add to what was said about the car standards piece and with a little bit on India, but also kind of the broader frame. We've got a member someone on our board who has a great phrase that I always come back to when we think about this, which is, we are going to succeed if we can articulate a yes strategy. And what that is, I mean, a positive vision for economic development, for poverty alleviation, for food security and energy security that's also a low-carbon vision. And so our challenge and where we're focused, where we have been focused in China and where you heard Kriti describe our focus in India, is to help create that vision so that villagers in India can make choices that improve their quality of life, that improve the health of the health of their children, and that put the country on a lower carbon trajectory. The cars piece is perhaps the toughest nut to crack there, because of the value of mobility and people. And so that's one where we're going to need to shift on to new technologies, get away from internal combustion, electrification, and so on. I'll tell you in the immediate term in India, you may know this, the issue is not the standards on the books. The issue is enforcement. And so when we think about how we're going to build a long-term strategy in India on air quality, we think about that as much through the lens of how do we build the institutional structures that will help India succeed. India, you know, you always hear about the rapid growth. India is a country under construction, right? 70% of the buildings are being built. That's also true for its institutions and its policies and its political infrastructure, and that's what we're trying to build so we have that enforcement and compliance, so that we're taking the lessons we've got from those 40,000 regulators we trained in China and applying them to India. So, but again, it's all part of that yes strategy, a positive vision that also leads towards low carbon. Jenny, to your question, it's a great question. It's a tough question. I was in San Francisco for the Global Climate Action Summit, and you know, at one point I made my way out of the Moscone Center where this was held, which was ringed by barricades, and I sat and sort of stood and watched the protests, and the energy was palpable. It was really, even for sort of someone who's been working this for a long time, it was really inspiring to see. And Jerry Brown is a real climate champion. So if I could have gone to some of those protesters, they're not going to listen to me, I was in a suit, but if I could go to those protesters and say, can we channel that energy toward holding accountable the people who are holding back progress rather than who are leading? We need to hold people we need to make sure that people who claim to be climate champions are, and we need to hold them accountable. But Jerry Brown has been a champion here, and I'd like to see that energy go to holding, to pushing people who need to do more, and holding accountable the people who are holding us back. And to be fair, many of the folks in that crowd who were chanting about Jerry Brown are also out there protesting, some of the fossil fuel companies that are holding us back. So, but that's my answer. But it's a tough one because there's so much energy there, and it's inspiring to see that. And our challenge as a community is how we challenge that, how we channel that into the most productive way.
Thanks, Nat. And now I'd like to come to Pete Klosterman's question about how we connect with the rancher who feels the tie to his land, or her land in the case of some ranchers that I know. And if you don't mind, I'd like to answer this one or address it. I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm from a small town. It's got a lot of farms around it. I'm familiar in some ways with the connection that people have to their land, especially in large parts of the United States that are outside of big cities. How, in my work at EDF, can I connect with that rancher? I work on one small part of the climate puzzle. It's been mentioned here a couple times. It's the amount of emissions we each are responsible for when we get on an airplane. And it turns out that it's really hard to fly airplanes on things other than jet fuel. There's a lot of people working on it, but jet fuel is pretty amazing for what it does in terms of taking a very heavy object and lifting it up and moving it rapidly through the air and putting it back down again. We have a fragile agreement among all the world's airlines and among most of the world's governments to cap the emissions of international flights at 2020 levels. Now, you may say that's not a terribly ambitious commitment. It goes from 2020 to 2035. If we're successful, it's about 2.5 billion tons of emissions that will either not go up into the air at all or will be offset by reductions achieved elsewhere. The airlines have agreed to this under threat of regulation by the European Union if they didn't reach agreement. And the airlines are starting to look for reductions both within the aviation sector, and they're talking about flying planes on fuel made from garbage and waste gases from steel and flowers that you can grow in your backyard. They're looking at all kinds of fuels. But they're also looking for reductions that they can use in the very near term until these new fuels of the future come on board. If I can connect the airline with the rancher who's looking to keep his livelihood or livelihood on a ranch, but ranching in ways that reduce emissions, that's a deal that I've got a bunch of airlines who want to make. And in my view, if we can get that deal going in the current political climate, because we have ranchers saying they want it and airlines saying they want it, we've got a toehold on the kinds of change that we're talking about. And those are the kinds of strategies that each of us at EDF, through your support and through our colleagues who consistently pound on us saying, what is your theory of victory here? Is it credible? Is it economically, scientifically, politically, marketing-wise credible? And keep us refining and improving those strategies. We were founded on the premise that environmental science combined with passionate advocacy could deliver environmental results. We're bringing the behavioral sciences, the social sciences, the economics into this, and we're taking the diverse perspectives of our staff around the world to try to tackle this environmental challenge of the 21st century for you, for your kids, for their kids. Thank you so much for your support. Stay and ask our staff members here more questions after we break, but I did promise to end on time, and we have. Thank you so much.